Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Hi, I want to thank all of you for coming. I'm Larry Flint. This is David Eisenbach. He's my co-author on the book, One Nation Under Sex. I'll tell you a little bit about it, and then David and I both will speak some, and afterwards we'll open it up for question and answers. When I decided to do this book, the first one I thought of was David, because I knew nobody would want to read a history book written by a pornographer. So I reached out for David, and he's very smart and did a lot of important work for the History Channel on the same subject matter. And he and I together was like hand and glove. We worked magnificently together because we had certain goals that we wanted to achieve. We were not interested in going back through history and just writing about people's sex lives. We wanted to see how the relationship between presidents, first ladies, mistresses, and lovers, how it actually affected policy. Even though there's been some very powerful women in history that had done a great deal to affect policy even before women had the right to vote. And I think in the book we've been able to capture this. And we started in the beginning with an effort to look and see, first of all, did the sex scandals that exist in our culture today, did they also exist with the founding fathers? And we found that they definitely did. No one wanted to believe that this great man, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, would actually father six children with his slave girl, Sally Hemings. And even though that had been made public, even during Jeffers' political tenure and as president, and it was fought very viciously, just like some things are today. But in going down and looking at these various things that happened, including Jefferson, for almost two centuries, nobody believed it. It was taken as a rumor. And then in 1998, through the science of DNA, it was established that Jefferson did father Sally Hemings' children. Now, it's strange that Jefferson of Washington was the only two founding fathers that never freed their slaves after the Revolutionary War. And there's been a lot of speculation there. I think I probably know why Jefferson didn't. But David, I'll tell you, you want to start with Buchanan?
Right. Well, the Jefferson case is just symptomatic of the general problem with history, the way we see it. Historians have traditionally just ignored the sex lives of presidents, and because they've seen sex as being just, a private matter, of something that is just not worthy of serious political history. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to bring those stories into and connect them to the greater story of America and seeing how the sex lives of presidents and first ladies shaped policy and how it shaped elections and foreign policy. And so, you know, we started with the Founding Fathers, and then we moved on through the greats of American history and the not-so-greats. James Buchanan, for example, was, you know, the worst president in the history of the United States. Pretty much all historians agree on that. But the big mystery was, you know, why was this guy who came from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in a fervently abolitionist part of the country, why was he so fervently pro-slavery? Why did he, when he's president of the United States, elected in 1856, encourage the South, turn a blind eye to the Southern secessionist movement? And then when the South started seceding after Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860, just allow the South to disappear? And historians have always been baffled by this, and they haven't come up with any good explanation. Well, if you look at his personal life, you begin to see, well, wait a second, there might be something here. He had a 32-year-long love affair with an Alabama senator named William Rufus King, who was a Southern plantation owner. And William Rufus King indoctrinated the young James Buchanan with a romantic vision of the slave owners and the notion that the slaves were better off with their masters. And James Buchanan takes this kind of notion, this romantic vision of the slave owner that he gets from his lover, into his political career, and ultimately it shapes the way he deals with the South while it's seceding in 1860. So that's just one example. In the 19th century, in the 20th century, we have, you know, Woodrow Wilson's affair that brought on his, you know, the inability to deal with the League of Nations. We have the Roosevelts with their affairs, Eleanor having her lesbian affairs that transform her from somebody with Victorian prejudices into somebody who is pro civil rights. Franklin Roosevelt himself, he wouldn't have become the president that we know. He wouldn't have even have been able to transcend polio in the wheelchair and become president of the United States without his mistress, Missy LaHand. Into the later half of the 20th century, we have J. Edgar Hoover, who builds this state within the state based on the sexual blackmail of every congressman, senator, president, and Supreme Court justice. And he's able to kind of create this undermining of the U.S. Constitution through sexual blackmail. So, even in our own time, the Monica Lewinsky story, you know, we tend to think right now, well, you know, this is old news. We've all heard the full story. Well, it turns out that the 9/11 Commission report actually explored how the administration was inhibited from going after Osama bin Laden more aggressively in the late 1990s because they were afraid during the Monica Lewinsky scandal of being accused of wagging the dog. So here, once again, you have, you know, a sex, you know, this thing that, you know, what historians have dismissed as being unimportant, playing a role in shaping, you know, our lives today. And, you know, this book is really unique because it's filled with, you know, love stories and titillating kind of facts about the presidents. But more importantly, it is correcting this blind side that historians had put up for generations. So, you know, we hope you really enjoy this, but more importantly, right for now, we're hoping that you have some questions about, you know, your favorite president, and if you have any, you want to know the dirt about him, or First Lady, mind you. Are there any questions?
No, we don't know what questions yet.
You don't want to?
A couple more things I'm going to cover before we get into question. I don't know if David said it or not. If he didn't, I want to say it. Buchanan was gay, and he was our first gay president. Probably be a long time before we have another one. I think it's important to note that. And he is also the only bachelor president. But we were particularly interested in doing this book about the power that first ladies or mistresses of presidents actually had, even though they were not elected to public office. And there's a couple of good examples of that. One, Dolly Madison, Eleanor Roosevelt. But let's take Dolly Madison as an example. She was married, of course, to James Madison, President of the United States. She had a couple of sisters that was pretty wild. And they used to throw parties at the White House, and they would invite members of the Continental Army to come down and party with them. So it got so out of hand that one of Madison's cabinet members had to go to him and say, "You know, Mr. President, I know you don't want to hear this, but your wife has single-handedly turned the White House into a brothel." And Dolly was always remembered by being the heroine that saved Washington's portrait when the British burned the White House. So, and she lived well into her 80s, much longer than people lived during that period in history. And when she died, it was the largest funeral ever held in Washington. The First Lady went there, and Rupert B. Hayes, the president, made a lot of excuses as to why he couldn't go. So Dolly Madison remained relevant to the very end from the time that she started.
The interesting thing about Dolly is, you know, here's a first lady who was vilified in the opposition press. Her husband, James Madison, was a Democratic Republican, and the opposition was the Federalists. And they resented her because she was the face of the administration. She was the one that, because James Madison had zero charisma, she was the one that was out there kind of pushing forward his agenda. And so they began to publish a lot of stories about how she was sleeping with a bunch of congressmen in order to win votes, a bunch of ambassadors in order to, you know, get, you know, U.S. Concessions in foreign policy. And what was interesting to us was how this woman, this first lady, was in the press, you know, presented as being, you know, this woman who's just sleeping around D.C. in a time period when we think, well, the founding fathers, they never dealt with each other's scandals. They never traded in each other's smut. That was not true at all. The founding fathers were constantly exposing each other's sex scandals and reveling in it. And the U.S. press at the time loved sex scandal. It's only until the 20th century, with the emergence of the national security state, that the press begins to see themselves as protectors of the president, that they were there to filter any stories that they heard around, you know, the bar room from the American people so that the national security would be remain intact. And that continues up until the end of the Cold War. And once the Cold War ends, and, of course, the internet then hits the scene. It becomes impossible to control sex scandal. The press no longer sees itself as the protector of the president, and we have the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So you can actually see how we start off with lots of sex scandals. Sex scandal disappears in the early 20th century, and then it reappears the beginning of the 20th century. In a weird way, we have returned to the days of the pamphleteers of the early founding fathers.
David and I often get asked, you know, which of the presidents was the biggest philanderer? And that probably was a toss-up between Jack Kennedy and Warren Harding, but Woodrow Wilson was in the mix as well. And there was historians have even said in the past that the difference between Woodrow Wilson and Warren Harding is Woodrow Wilson liked the brothels of Paris and Harding like the whorehouses of Columbus, Ohio. And it's amazing how Harding even got into politics. He was coming back to a picnic area from an outhouse and at a party north of Columbus, and two political operatives seen him and said, "My, isn't that man handsome? Wouldn't he make a great senator?" So they ran him for Senate. He got elected, and eventually he got elected as president. And he reigned over the absolute worst presidency that we have ever had, and even to this date. But to give you a little special insight with Harding, he was only interested in getting laid. That's his main preoccupation. And when he had girls in the White House, he always wanted to get them in a different place, you know, the pantry or the broom closet or this or that. And these escapades of his were legendary. And John Kennedy was aware of them and said he'd like to go every place Harding had been. But Harding, and it had nothing to do with sex, but it's such a great story about this guy. When he was elected president, one of the first things he wanted to do was change the national emblem from the eagle to the chicken, because he felt there was more chickens than there were eagles. And that's what a doofus this guy was, okay? And the only thing that I can ever think about good that came out of his administration is the most famous political speech probably ever made that many of you have heard and seen time and time again, is Jack Kennedy saying, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." That was stolen from a speech that Harding gave many years before. And not for some reason or another, you know, the press hasn't felt it necessary to make that point. But I think it's very interesting.
Harding was quite a wordsmith. And when you read the book, you'll see we quote extensively from his love letters to his mistress, Carrie Phillips. And they are absolutely hot. I mean, it's as if Daniel Steele wrote these lines. And the funny thing about Harding is that he gets involved with this mistress, Carrie Phillips, who is the wife of his best friend. And they carry on a 17-year-long affair. And during the First World War, she was a German sympathizer and was investigated by the Bureau of Investigation, later to become the FBI, for being a German spy. Well, Harding knows this, but of course he is head over heels in love with Carrie Phillips. So he refuses to dump her, and he continues to see her. And even after the First World War ends, he decides he's going to run for president, not only with this mistress who's suspected of being a German spy, but also with an illegitimate daughter, with a young girl from his hometown of Marion, Ohio. Well, he goes to the convention, and the Republican Party bosses bring him into the smoke-filled room, and they're like, "Warren, you know, we think you can win the nomination tomorrow, but is there anything in your background that could possibly prevent you from becoming president of the United States?" And he takes 10 minutes to think about it, and he comes back and he says, "No, gentlemen, there's absolutely nothing in my background that can prevent me from winning this election." Well, the next day after he gets the nomination, he comes back to them and says, "Well, I forgot to tell you a couple of things." Well, Carrie Phillips had already tried to blackmail him before, and now that he's the presidential nominee for the Republican Party, she knows she's got some big bucks coming to her, and the Republican Party actually organizes a slush fund to pay off Mrs. Phillips and Mr. Phillips and sends them on a whirlwind tour of Asia. They pay off Nan Britton and they pay off all these other mistresses. And the big question is, all right, well, who's kicking in the money and why are they kicking in the money? Well, the answer comes when he's president of the United States and he oversees the most corrupt administration in the history of American politics, the Teapot Dome scandal. Well, that was just the tip of the iceberg. All of the guys who chipped in figured, well, we're going to get some money on the back end, and they did. They cashed in. So once again, the sex stories, while fun and interesting, actually wound up having huge political implications in this administration.
I just wanted to add one thing. David said, when referred to his other mistress, Nan Britton, he actually had a child by her. And she sued as well. And today's dollars, it would have been a large amount of money. It wasn't a lot of money back then, but again, the Republican Party actually had to pay off his mistresses, both Kay Phillips and Nan Britton. So,
well, all right, thank you very much, guys. You're wonderful.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.